Hi everyone, I'm Bart and I'm part of the team on Australian True Crime. Before we begin this week's episode, we wanted to share with you another podcast we have all been enjoying recently, Hong Kong Confidential. Here's Jules from Hong Kong Confidential to tell you more.
Hong Kong Confidential, a podcast with Jules Hannaford, is designed to educate and entertain my audience. It's an interview-style show where many topical social issues are discussed and personal stories are shared. The podcast can be inspiring, confronting, harrowing, and at times hilarious. All of the stories have uplifting messages. We all need to be heard to heal, and listening to the experiences of others can often help the rest of us deal with whatever life has to throw at us. Find Hong Kong Confidential on Auscast Network at www.auscastnetwork.com. Hong Kong Confidential is also available on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher and YouTube, and anywhere that you can find your podcasts. Check out Hong Kong Confidential today.
And soon as Mum and Dad saw each other, that was it. They knew.
The double murder of teenagers Fiona Burns and John Lee in 1990 on the South Australia-Victorian border is still unsolved despite exhaustive investigations, big rewards offered, and even the case being featured on the Million Dollar Cold Case TV program. With no apparent motive and no witnesses coming forward, there's some fading hope it will ever be solved, and there's a brutal killer still out there.
This is Australian True Crime. Come with us as we explore how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
Barbie McCarthy was just 12 years old when her big sister Fiona was stabbed to death. And she's joined us because she wants help from anyone listening who might hold a missing piece of information or know someone who does that can solve this dreadful crime. So, Barbie, thanks so much for contacting us because you want to talk to our listeners about the case, the murder of your sister and her friend John in 1990. And it's a case that seems to have gone pretty cold, but, you know, there's still work going on, isn't there, to find out who killed your sister and John, and they were only kids.
Yeah, there's still, we've got a cold case detective that's dedicated to our case as well, and from time to time we still get updates and things are still going on in the background, but it takes time.
Gosh, I remember these photos of your sister because I was in year 12 in 1990. So your sister was a little bit younger than me, but definitely this was one of those cases that our parents pointed to on the news and said, see, it's dangerous out there. Tell us about your sister. Who was she? What was she doing out and about at 15 years of age?
15 years of age. Fiona, Mum and Dad were going for a separation, which is always tumultuous in any teenager's life. Mm. Fiona had moved out from my mum's to my dad's to an auntie's and just sort of couldn't find a place where she was happy. And on a few occasions she ran away from home, but we always seemed to find that she was running away to Adelaide and still to this day do not know why she went to Adelaide. Mm.
Mm. From where? Where were you all living?
In Langwarrin, Victoria.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. So that's a big trip. So yeah. Was she hitchhiking?
Yes, yeah, she was hitchhiking.
Okay, so that's 8-hour, 9-hour drive?
Oh, yeah, about that. Yeah. You know, back in that day, yeah. Everyone was hitchhiking.
Longer probably.
Long drive, yeah, okay.
Yeah, you're right. I was talking with someone the other day and saying, remember when you were driving around with your mum and dad and you saw hitchhikers a lot? You just don't see that anymore.
No, it's just become not safe.
Yeah. This is part of why I think as kids, you know, my parents were always drumming into me, it's not safe. Did she always hitchhike with her mate John?
No, John is only someone that she met in Adelaide. He was an Adelaide boy.
Oh.
And she'd met him on her last trip up there. So they'd only had a brief relationship or friendship.
Mm. And he was only 14 too. So 14 and 15, they're just kids.
Absolutely.
Breaking
and
out.
Only just 15 because she was 15 in the August.
Yeah.
So
what was his story? What do we know about John?
Well, John was living in a group home for young people. I'm not too sure about his family background. The family didn't have a lot to do with any sort of media or any at the time.
Oh, the poor little bugger.
No. Yes. I was thinking I'd never heard anything about his family. I've obviously seen pictures of your parents and you speaking
They never
out.
Got involved. They never showed any interest.
That's really so sad.
It's really sad. So Fiona's met John, who's only 14. He's been living in a group home, which is a tough life. She's met him in Adelaide during one of her previous trips.
Yep.
Wonder why she kept going to Adelaide. Yep. That's such a weird place to go.
To this day, we just do not know who was up there or why Adelaide.
Yeah. How many times did she go over there?
I think three that we know of.
Okay. So did he come back here to meet her, or how did they end up together on this day?
The trip that they were coming back to, that was when he was coming back to meet the family.
Oh.
Fiona rang up my dad 2 weeks prior to when they were found and said, "I've got a surprise for you." And we're guessing that it was her new friend.
Mm. Little John.
Yeah. And you were 12 at the time. So what was it like for you with big sister Fiona
going off?
And you were also going through your own situation with your mum and dad breaking up.
Yeah, well, I was living with my mum in Dramana and my sister was living with one of my aunties in Langwarrin. I hadn't seen a lot of Fiona probably 6 months prior to that, only because of the family breakdown and the distance and, you know, teenage girls, sisters that weren't always seen eye to eye.
Yeah.
I was the annoying little sister.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just didn't see her a lot before that. I remember seeing her Christmas before and maybe once at my grandmother's house, and that was it.
Was she always out there? Was she always the sort of rebellious out there one?
No, she was quite a quiet person. She was interested in science and she's very naturally smart.
But just a bit spun out by the family breakdown?
Yeah, I think that's done a lot of changing.
Yeah, and at 15 too, there's a lot of changing going on anyway, isn't there?
Yeah, finding your, you know, place in school and
your
friendship groups, it's just a huge time.
So for reasons unknown, she starts taking herself off to Adelaide of all places. Then she announces to your dad she's coming home, she's bringing a surprise, which we think is John. So did the family become aware that she was missing, in inverted commas?
Yes, Mum had reported her missing when we hadn't heard from her.
Right.
Because Fiona had made the phone call on a Friday and I think they hadn't heard from her for about a week.
Okay.
And that was quite a long time for nobody to hear from her. Yeah. So then they reported her, and then the following week is when there were two bodies found, still unidentified, and I think it was still another few days before we got my dad got the phone call.
So what do you know about what happened? So what's been reported, but what do you know? Tell us about the murder, how it was discovered, and what happened afterwards.
From my understanding is that the two people found the bodies on the side of the road while they were out collecting seeds of some sort.
And this was around Kniva, isn't it? Which is on the Victoria, South Australia border where a lot of people stop off, you know, on their way to Adelaide.
Yeah, Fiona and John were travelling from Adelaide. They went through Border Town along the way, must have got tripped picked up at some point and then dropped off. So then they got picked up by whoever killed them, and apparently they weren't murdered where they were found. Because of the way the bodies were positioned, and there was no crime scene, so to speak. And they were out there for 2 weeks, apparently, in the elements.
Their bodies were hidden, presumably, not easily found.
Yeah. They were off the road. I don't think they were made any effort to particularly hide the bodies. They were just off the side of the road.
So presumably, well, the vehicle that they were picked up in could have been the crime. The crime scene or a house or
somebody's place, and then dumped out there. It's all pretty awful to think about, really.
Yeah.
When did your parents become aware that this could be Fiona? Do you remember, do police phone your family and say, "We've found two bodies on the highway between Adelaide and Melbourne"? Do they let them know at that point, or do they wait until they're pretty sure?
My understanding is that they rang my father at work and told him.
That they thought it was Fiona? Yeah.
Well, identification of clothing and...
Right. Wow. Okay. Oh, God. And then does he have to phone your mum? How does that work?
Well, at the time my dad was working at a shopping centre where my mum's two sisters also had a business, so he went and told them, and I was told it was home that day because it was a curriculum day of school and I'm at home doing craft and my mum's there and all my aunties walk in the door with my dad and my grandparents, and I'm like, what's going on here? You know
something's up.
And as soon as Mum and Dad saw each other, that was it.
Mm.
They knew.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Mum knew. But the whole family walked in, and it was just really, really strange to see that.
Now, this is hard because my understanding is that you actually didn't know at the time a lot of the insinuations that were going on, a lot of the rumours, a lot of the ideas the police were coming up with, right? Your family didn't talk to you a lot about
it. No, they didn't talk to me personally about it. I found out from kids at school and the news.
Oh, wow.
What was the media coverage like of the murders?
Two runaway kids, two kids that were in cults, skinning dogs and drinking their blood.
Where did that come from?
My sister had a book in her bag, which was Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
which joking. Probably everyone watched at that
time. Yeah, it was the 90s.
It was the top show, wasn't it?
And in 1990, there seemed to be a huge lot of media about cults popping up all over the place, and it just happened to be around that time.
Mm.
And I don't know, maybe they just went with that.
That's where it started. Because, yeah, when you Google the story, you do get a lot of cult stuff. Is that really where it came from?
Mm.
And, look, when journalists are trying to get their stories out and about, they're going to grab a lot of different information. And, you know, if someone says, oh, yeah, they were involved in this, that's a soundbite for them. I mean, it's
Here's a story. Fiona was reportedly counselled over claims she witnessed and took part in a sickening satanic ritual in Victoria during which a dog was hurt, blah, blah, blah. I won't go into the details. But so people are coming forward then with quite specific stories about what they've heard and what they've, you know. No names, of course. No counsellor is actually named as to who was supposed to have counselled her over this. Just really rumours.
Mm, all rumours.
How bizarre.
Because Fiona was an absolute animal lover. We had seven cats and they were all, she used to call herself Fifi, you know, which is what our cats were called, you know.
Also, I see her described as a street kid.
Yeah, not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all.
And that kind of information, did it kind of set the investigation off in a bit of a way that might have not been helpful?
Yeah, I think it gave a perception that Fiona and John were not really worth the effort.
Yeah.
That's how we felt, because they were just street kids. They weren't, you know, members of society who were useful or helpful or good.
And, I mean, they're only 14 and 15. They're just kids. Mm. And as we spoke about before, you know, if this happened today, no stone would be left unturned. Yeah. And I'm
street
not saying...
kids or not.
Yeah, that's it. And I don't think... I'm not saying that the cops didn't do everything they could, but I guess when you're getting a lot of varied information, it's they're going to follow that, aren't they? And it's not necessarily going to be going in the way that is helpful.
Mm.
What kind of witnesses were talking to the police that you've learnt of since? Like who had good information to give?
There's a few truck drivers that had information about seeing them hitchhiking. Fiona had a bright orange mohawk.
Mm-hmm. So she stood out.
Yep, she stood out. There was a few people in cars that just mentioned how they'd seen them along the way. A shop in Bordertown where they had popped in apparently.
Truck driver who said that she had woken him up and asked for a cigarette.
Yep.
And also for a lift to Melbourne, and he had refused both. But he did come forward and tell police that he had seen her.
Yeah.
I think he may have been the last person who said that he'd seen it. Right up to Bordertown. We know their movements pretty much, and then it goes cold. Your parents and your family didn't talk to you much about it. Were they talking to each other? I mean, how was the family coping in the weeks and months afterwards as the investigation? At the time, was the investigation pretty energetic in the beginning?
Oh, I'd say so in the first few weeks.
Yeah.
But, you know, you've got one murder and quickly soon after that another one follows. So, you know, attention does steer elsewhere.
And it was difficult for many reasons. The bodies had been outside for a period of time, which made it difficult to find evidence around there. And for a lot of reasons, the investigation was difficult. And I guess weeks turn into months and turns into years.
Yeah.
So how did your family then cope as time went on?
Well, as time goes on, there's a lot of guilt from the adult family members. I mean, we were children.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of fractured relationships, a family that's pretty much decimated as far as communication goes. You know, we were a big, close family. Now we're sort of all on our own, doing our own thing now. And I think it has a lot to do with the trauma wasn't dealt with individually and as a unit, or it just wasn't dealt with the right way. Nowadays, I mean, I know for children, they have great supports out there. I know that when we were children, there wasn't a lot going on there.
Did you get any counselling at all?
Not until later in life.
Yeah.
It just wasn't. What did they try? Just didn't have it. Well, the only counselling I got was crimes compensation when I was 17. Mm. That's it. Never offered any at school, never offered any at home. It was always sort of about the parents because, you know, the loss of a child, I think the children got lost in the journey.
What do you think the theory was at home? Do you think the grown-ups were saying, don't talk to her about it, or... Did they ever sort of
think they thought we're resilient and we're children and we'll get on with our lives?
Yeah.
Yeah, or they won't remember it. I've done some stuff around sort of a few years previous, but 1984, the murder of Margaret and Shauna Tapp.
Mm.
And I know people who went to school with Shauna because we're of the same age. Because
Shauna had an older brother, right, who wasn't home that night.
Yeah, and so they're all around Ferntree Gully. And actually someone I spoke to for a story, he's actually sadly since died. He had a lot of struggles, but he said he – the kids just weren't allowed to go to the funeral. Mm. Like, you know, it was just very hard for his parents to talk to him about it. I guess, how do you talk about your child's classmate being killed? But, you know, for you, you're 12. How were you treated by teachers?
I think I've classmates? Got a wide berth a lot of the time because I think people are worried that you're going to cry on them and what do they do?
Mm-hmm.
Or there's the opposite where people want to know information. They want to know, you know, the gritties of it all and what really happened and how did it happen. So it was very isolating and very intrusive depending on where the people were coming from. As far as teachers concerned, there was really no effort by not even the welfare or anybody to even acknowledge what had happened. Even the schools, I mean, I remember a few years ago when with the Luke Batty situation, the whole school had support and the Windermere services supported everybody and offered counselling. Nowadays, that's nowadays, but back then it was nothing. No. There wasn't anything to even support the victims or the families of the victims.
What do you recall of that time with how your feelings and how you were seeing the world and what was happening and what your parents were going through?
Oh, I think my parents were just too busy dealing with their own grief. I don't think they knew what to do with us. It was just and to see Mum upset, and then you don't want to go and upset her more by you being upset. And I think because I was just that little bit older.
It's the ultimate intrusion into a family, isn't it, too, that an unknown person or people has come in and brutally taken someone away from you, and to still never know who or why or how or must make you feel incredibly sort of vulnerable.
It makes you very cautious with people and weary and always on alert of what if or could that be the person.
Like
if I see stuff on the TV now, could that I'll check the timelines, I think how old are they, where were they, you know, and that sort of thing. And I'm always bothering my detective.
There was a moment where they looked into Ivan Milat.
Yeah. And you know, I still wonder.
Travelled around.
It was
a lot.
His area.
Yeah.
But it just wasn't where he used to leave his bodies.
What are some of the leads over the years that have sort of been looked at but kind of been discounted, like eliminated?
Well, we've had people in jail say they know information, but when it came to time for them to speak up, you know, they changed their stories.
So what happens in that situation? Your detective calls you and says some guy in Barwon reckons he knows something. Is that what happens?
Yeah, pretty much. And we had to do a media release a few years back because someone had said something in a jail and they wanted to do a fake media release to see whether that person would speak up again to an undercover detective in the jail.
Mm.
So.
And then what? Then we wait?
And nothing happened from that. And you know, there's been a few people that they've spoken to and they've done quite well with travelling interstate and even overseas to talk to these people. But with time past, some of the people they've spoken to are, you know, damaged from alcohol and drug abuse and it's a long time ago. Memories fade.
They do, but then also they say this is the key to the cold case, is that as time goes by, relationships change, and that's kind of the key. Loyalties change. Mm.
Yeah,
people who were in relationships, those relationships end, whatever. People who were scared of somebody else aren't scared of them anymore. And
I think that's the hope we hold out for.
Yeah.
And with this $1 million reward, we would have hoped that something would come from that, because, you know, people who do these sort of things, they've got to talk at some point.
After the break, Barbie tells us about some of the claims made in the media that diverted the investigation and upset the family. And they do say a big reward often flushes out information. Tell us about being involved in the show, which was Million Dollar Cold Case, and it was a television program that really featured heavily some cases that were really just kind of seemingly going nowhere. So tell us about what happened with that.
And we had quite a few phone calls from that, and a few leads were followed up, but with time passed, you know, that I think they just struggled to find evidence.
Mm.
You know, it was quite hard to do that. Case, and even when they did do the TV show, I learnt stuff that I didn't even know.
Like what? Tell us.
The lead up to Fiona leaving home, to the runaway, to, you know, going to visit my dad, and I just didn't know those things. And seeing the reenactment on TV, it had her bag, and I didn't even know they had all these things. Mm. And it was actually her bag, and like, I want that, you know. I didn't even know they had those things.
So that's all in the evidence locker.
And just the path that they took and stopping off at train stations and things like that. I didn't know all those sort of things. And I've read everything that I thought that there was. I've seen crime scene photos, I've seen everything, and I thought I knew it all. Yeah, the things that you find out.
Are you really the voice for Fiona now?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. There's no one else in the family who have got the strength to do it anymore. Mum's just not up for it anymore. It's just been too hard for her. And that my dad did come with me last year to do the cold case, and my auntie Annette as well, who Fiona was living with at the time. But I think they just really struggle emotionally. So it's always something that I've just sort of moved forward with. Someone needs to speak up. Someone needs to be there.
Where do you get your support from these days? What's life been like for you since you become an adult and forging your own life?
I studied youth work when I was at university, and I think that gave me a lot of understanding of my feelings and what I went through as a teenager.
Mm.
And I think that, and then I went into working with victims of crime. It's just someone needs to be there for the now people who are victims. No one was there for me, and I want to be there for somebody else, especially children.
Mm.
Children just seem to be looked over, and I think that's hardest for me to see.
Mm.
No, it's just so sad, and it goes on for generations. I've got three young girls myself, and even my oldest daughter has been picked on about my sister's murder. So,
really?
Yeah.
Wow, what do you mean?
Yeah, well, she was in grade prep, so it was a few years ago now, because she's in high school now, but we did a media release. I think it might have been 20-year anniversary of the murders, and it was on the TV. And the next day she went to school, and one of her friend's mums had told her, the little girl, that she's not allowed to play with her anymore because her mum's sister was murdered.
Oh my God, how bizarre.
That's just given the perception that we're not good people because we've had that in our lives, and you know, that's just pushed me more. You need to educate people that it happens to everybody.
Yeah.
You know, rich, poor, good, bad.
It really does.
Doesn't matter.
Did you feel stigmatised when you were younger?
Yeah, absolutely.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, murder was seen as something that only happens to a certain type of person. Mm.
Really? And the way they were portrayed in the media didn't help at all. You know, runaways.
So you must be the same. You must be in cults as well. It wasn't great.
How have you parented your girls then? Like, how was what happened to Fiona? We ask this a lot about people who have had siblings or parents murdered. How does that make you parent?
Well, my girls are still quite young. They're only 9, 10 and 12. My eldest is the same age I was now.
Well, you're just coming into it though. You've got a 12-year-old. Do you think about – I've got an 8-year-old. Yeah, so even now I think 12, about
– 9-year-old.
Like, I don't let them do sleepovers or anything like that yet. You know, what do you think?
I'm very careful about that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I need to know who they are. I need to I'd probably suss out people a bit more than I should.
Yeah.
Like my daughter walking home from school, but, you know, I need to let that happen.
Mm.
You
know.
And over the years, there's obviously been several police officers involved. Ron Edel was involved, wasn't he?
Initially. It's gone over the years where they've had cold case units and then they haven't had cold case units. And I think the times where they didn't have cold case units is where it was just neglected.
Yeah.
Because we just didn't hear from detectives probably for about 6 years until I started poking my head in, because it just sort of disappeared.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and what I've learnt too is that funding is a big issue, and that when something like, say, the Melbourne gangland wars flares up, suddenly all the funding goes to that. And so cases like this just get no, you know, attention.
Yeah, and that did happen. It was had to do with those as well. We were told that there's no money at the moment because they wanted to go to New Zealand to speak to somebody because they had to put it elsewhere.
Yeah. We're too busy chasing the Morans around and all of their associates, so we can't actually go and look at these old cases. Yeah. Yeah. So all of those issues pop up and you're left for years on end with no one looking into this case. And meanwhile, as you say, memories get hazier, people die, stuff happens.
Yeah.
So you're a detective now, you don't have to name the person, but talk to us about that relationship. I mean, do you phone that person once a week? Do they phone you? How does that work?
I probably email them quite regularly.
Okay.
Just stuff that I come up with.
Mm.
But he rings probably every couple months just to update me if something has or hasn't happened.
Because we've heard about this from the detective's point of view many times, about certain relatives who will phone them on the dot of 10 o'clock every Monday or whatever, and they've never ever complained about it. I want to make that very clear. But, yeah, it's just an interesting relationship and how it keeps it real for them, and they definitely feel it on a very personal level.
Absolutely. We had a great detective for 8 years and he's only just finished up with us in the last year, and he would ask me how my day is. He talked about his family life. It was a real good relationship when we saw each other, you know.
And to retire without finishing.
He was most unhappy.
Yeah.
he was sad that he couldn't do that for us in his time. You know, he's moved on to other things now, and we've got a new one who's taken some new angles, but, you know, and he's been very good too. They're just really easy to talk to and happy to listen, even if I am just going off in my tangents, you know, they listen to me.
Have you had any real tangents, any real persons of interest? Have you had any interesting, you know?
Quite a few years ago I read the inquest. I think that's what it's called, or the brief.
Oh, yeah?
And I pointed out a few people in there to the detective at the time. I said, well, why haven't these people been spoken to? You know, they're mentioned in here, and it wasn't until I'd said something that they actually chased them up.
Okay. Mm.
Because they were people who actually said they did it, and one of them had produced a knife, just, you know, it was proved, well, he's been interviewed and they've ruled him out now, but the fact that he said that and he hadn't been spoken to, I was just, why wouldn't you have done that 15 years ago when?
Mm.
But there was three people they chased up from my investigations.
Yeah.
You know, it's just crazy stuff. And I think that was in those few years when they sort of lost the cold case unit.
And I think back then often police were doing a main job, and then they might get a couple of files of old cases to follow up, you know.
Absolutely,
which, who's going to have time to do that, honestly, you know?
And nowadays, murders every other day. I think back when Fiona was killed, it was maybe once a week you might hear a murder, but now it's just most days.
And Fiona and John's murder, I think what always strikes me is just the thought they were so young. It was a very violent crime.
Mm.
And there's someone, well, we don't know if the perpetrator is dead or alive, but there's a very violent child killer out there. That's what I'm going to call it, because they're children and he would have known their young people.
And they were small teenagers too. So Fiona was only 5 foot tall and John was only a small boy. They would have looked like children.
Yeah, you know? And it's just it's very dangerous people out there.
Mm. There's a theory that there could have been more than one perpetrator as well.
Yep.
So we will definitely link to your Facebook page in case anyone listening has any information. That happens a lot too, that people don't realise that something they know is of interest, is important.
The smallest detail, a car, a person, someone's just mentioned something at the pub or, you know, any small bit of information.
Because they don't really know, do they, where possibly they may have been picked up from on the way to Conniver or that. So I guess there's the gaps in that information that
all they know is hard. They can trace them to Bordertown. That's the last place they can really trace them
to. And Bordertown to Conniver is not that far, is it? I don't think so. Something's happened between Bordertown and so if we've got, you know, we do have a big listenership all over the world now, actually, and hopefully someone might know something. We have had some messages over the time we've been doing this podcast about this case. Just people, we go like, tell us what you're interested in listening to, and some people go, what about that case? Or so. It was really, really great when you contacted us because you're just exploring every avenue.
Whenever it pops up on the news or things like that, I actually look through the people's comments, and I've actually met two people that were hanging around Fiona at the time.
Yeah. Wow.
From
comments
doing
are amazing,
that.
Aren't
and
they?
And I've kept a relationship with these two people, and she was with Fiona the last few days before.
No way.
Fiona and John.
In Adelaide?
She was in the home with John. She lived in the home with John.
What did she have to say?
She was just telling me about what they got up to, that sort of thing. She didn't know Fiona as well. She just knew John.
Even that is amazing.
But just, she was able to give information about people who they were hanging around with and where they were going in Adelaide, you know, when they were hanging around doing teenage stuff on them.
Yeah. Mm. She didn't have any ideas as to what kept attracting her over there, apart from John in the end.
No.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
How old were you when you started to sort of take the lead in this?
I think I was 19 because I think from 17 to 19, I really struggled with it. That was when I was put through counselling and I just couldn't get it out of my head. I'd been bullied a little bit at high school about Fiona's murder and people saying horrible things, you know, go eat your chopped up sister and just horrible stuff. And that sort of stuff never leaves you and you just think about it all the time and, you know, people asking you what did she look like and all that sort of stuff. And that was really, I don't know, it just sort of stuck with me. So for me to stop that, I actually had to see everything and it stopped after that.
That's when you...
I stopped thinking about that particular stuff.
That's when you saw the crime photos and stuff like that, the crime scene photos.
I was 19 when that happened, when I saw those.
Wow. You would have been a teen around the time of the Frankston serial killings.
Yeah, I think it was only a year or two after.
Yeah, and living around that area. Did that kind of trigger you as well? Or, yeah. It's just, did that have an impact?
I think Fiona went to school with Paul Digne. No. It's all a bit scary.
Does it trigger you, that stuff? Do you have PTSD to that extent that you get triggered by that stuff? By other crimes?
I think only that I think because I overthink them, thinking, oh, could it have been, you know, where is it? Like when there's murders up in that part of Australia, in Northern Territory, you know, South Australia, I'll look at their ages, their timelines, and, you know, what their crime is, and then I'll contact my detective and say, can you just have it? And he always does. He always does what I ask. But I guess it does trigger because I'm having those thoughts when I see that sort of stuff. Mm. You know, general day-to-day life, I think I do quite well, but those sort of things brings it up.
I've heard that before. There's a case that I'm quite interested in as well, and I've actually formed a friendship with the mum of a girl who went missing around Healesville back in, it was 1980, late 1980s, Susie Lawrence, and she was 17 and just disappeared, right? Mm. You know, there's a lot of different things happening, but yeah, like back then they treated her like she'll come back. The local cops like she'll come back. You know, it was like a country town back then. But Susie's mum Liz once said to me, you know, she sometimes in the back of her mind wonders if Ivor Milat was ever in that area, just things like that. So she's often thinking, for a long time she just could not deal with the thought that Susie had come to foul play, whereas Liz's partner in late life was like, obviously something's happened, but yeah, it's only really now she's older, she's in her 70s, she's like, I really need to know. And that family had been fractured, like the brothers had all been differently affected and coped with it. And it's just like, how, I just wonder, why don't more people come up with information? Someone knows something. That's what triggers me. I'm like, after all these years, you know.
There's a lifelong thinking of scenarios.
Yeah.
And that's what I think just eats your time and your mind and your concentration, because you're thinking, you know, how did it happen? Could it have been this or that? And you think, you get into deep thought about the scenario. And I think that's what you need to stop. You need closure to stop those thoughts, to get your mind back.
Do you do things like your self-care? We like to ask about this too. Like, how do you take care of yourself? Do you know, exercise, meditation?
Yeah, I like to exercise. If I don't exercise, I get quite you know, hung up about it, you know, or just edgy.
Yeah.
That's what does it for me. I think I manage my stress quite easy, easier now, whereas younger I didn't understand what it was. So I just thought it was me. And I'm not an overly social person. I like to keep to myself. And I think that's something that's learned over the time because of this situation and the people who were either genuine or not, or the way you were treated by people just made you stay on your own a bit, I think.
I can't believe people could bully you about your murdered sister. I was just thinking that.
High school kids can be horrible.
Yeah. Do you tell people, new people that you meet, how long?
Not really.
No.
If someone asks or you know, if someone says, you know, how many siblings have you got? And I'll just say, oh, my older sister, but she's passed. And then, you know, younger sister and brother, blah, blah, blah. Some will be curious and ask how, and then it will go into that.
Mm.
And they'll either stop it in its tracks because too hard, or they're inquisitive. And I don't have a problem with talking about it anymore. I'm not going to sit there and bore my eyes out and, you know, it's been a long time now. But if they're interested, I'm quite happy to educate. Because I just feel that's what my job is now, is to educate the community that this sort of thing happens to anybody, and they need to look after, you know, young people when this sort of stuff happens.
And when you were working with victims of crime, children, your young people, did you meet a lot of kids in similar situations?
I met a lot of adults who were kids when they were in the situation. I was working in a lot of working groups with the Department of Justice Victims of Crime Consultative Committee. I was one of the first board members for that. It was about changing the way that the law enforcement treat victims of crime, making changes. Did a bit of public speaking for that sort of stuff. After I did that, I had a lot of workers come up to me and she'd go and would say to me, you know, I never thought about the kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was dealing with the mother, but I never thought about the kids.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and that's what I want to get out there. Of course, mum and dad are going to be in a terrible state, but the children need to be supported too. I think that a lot of people just look at the kids and they're playing and they're doing what kids do and thinking, oh, they must be okay.
Yeah. And there's a lot of sending the kids away too, isn't there? There's a lot of go to your room and play, go and watch the telly, go and while I deal with mum.
And they're assuming that the kids must be fine because they're playing their games or they're doing their thing.
They're being quiet.
Yeah.
So you've got an opportunity to say what you want here. Like, what do you want to say to our listeners? What would you urge them to do?
Just would like anybody, if they have any information, no matter how insignificant they may think it is, that, you know, a family is a family out here that need closure. We need support and we need somebody to say something. Just need that little bit of information.
Yeah, Fiona Burns and John Lee, who were 14 and 15 in 1990, who were hitchhiking from Adelaide to Melbourne. We know they made it to Bordertown, and then soon after that they were taken by somebody and murdered. And there is currently $1 million reward. Is that current?
Yes, it is.
$1 million reward for information leading to charges being laid for that murder. Thank you so much, Barbie. Good luck.
Thanks,
Thank
Barbie.
You for your time.
If you know anything that could help solve this case, please phone Crime Stoppers on 1800 333 000 or go to crimestoppers.com.au. Thank you for downloading Australian True Crime, and thank you to our team, which is one person, Bartholomew Heeran. If you enjoy the podcast, please take the time to leave us a nice review and 5 stars and to follow us on Facebook. Sorry, I didn't know you were